From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Reminiscing in tempo on this edition of Fresh Air, Mercer Ellington joins us to discuss his father, the late Duke Ellington, and the Duke Ellington Orchestra, which Mercer has conducted since his father's death in 1974. Also today, actor Bob Hoskins tells how a case of mistaken identity led to his acting career. Many of us ended the weekend by watching the Saturday Night Live anniversary special. TV critic David Bianculli shares his thoughts on 15 years of Saturday Night Live. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. President Bush has challenged the Soviet Union to make massive cuts in its stockpiles of chemical weapons. The president issued his call in his first speech at the United Nations since becoming chief executive.
The United States is ready to begin now. We will eliminate more than 80% of our stockpile, even as we work to complete a treaty if the Soviet Union joins us in cutting chemical weapons to an equal level, and we agree on the conditions, including inspections, under which stockpiles are destroyed.
The president told the UN General Assembly that the world has lived too long in the shadow of chemical warfare. Only the U.S. and Soviet Union admit to having poison gas, but Bush said more than 20 nations have chemical weapons and are able to produce them. South African President F.W. de Klerk has given his first interview to an international news organization since being inaugurated last week. In the BBC interview, he reaffirmed that there are no prospects at the present time for the release of nationalist leader Nelson Mandela. The BBC's Mike Woolrich reports.
South Africa is going through a period of intense speculation about the possible timing of Mr. Mandela's release, fueled by recent ministerial comments that it would be high on the new government's agenda and could happen within weeks, and even more so by a report today in the government-supporting Afrikaans newspaper Beeld of rumors that Mr. Mandela might be freed by this weekend in order to attend a politically significant funeral in Transkei. Asked about the speculation and the pressure both from within South Africa and from the international community for Mr. Mandela to be released, Mr. de Klerk said,
I can't make any prediction as to whether it will be this year or next year or whenever it will be.
Mr. de Klerk referred to the fact that Mr. Mandela himself said after his meeting with former President P.W. Botha that his immediate release was not an issue. He must have had reasons for saying that, said Mr. de Klerk.
The BBC's Mike Woolrich. The chairman of the House investigative panel today turned down an 11th-hour request by lawmakers for former HUD Secretary Samuel Pierce to delay his subpoenaed testimony about alleged fraud and abuse, but he said he would enforce a House rule permitting Pierce to bar broadcast coverage. Chairman Tom Lantos and House Speaker Thomas Foley were named as defendants in a lawsuit filed by television networks seeking to block Pierce's use of the rule. U.S. District Judge Joyce Hens Green denied the network's petition for a temporary restraining order. The House Appropriations Committee today approved a measure designed to keep government agencies in business when the new fiscal year begins in 6 days. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 22 points to close at 2659.19. Declines led advances 5-2 on volume of 122 million shares. This is NPR News. The weather is playing havoc with cleanup plans for Charleston, South Carolina. Taylor Lewis of member station WSCI reports.
Heavy rain and gusty winds have delayed efforts to get this county back to some kind of normalcy. Homeless residents of Sullivan's Island and Isle of Palms, who are being kept away for safety reasons by a martial law decree, showed up for ferry boat service transportation to the neighboring islands, only to find that the service had been canceled until further notice because of the weather. State police have been posted there to keep an already intense situation under control. Meanwhile, as a countywide 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. curfew remains in effect, commuter service in and out of the Charleston International Airport has been canceled until further notice. For National Public Radio, I'm Taylor Lewis in Charleston, South Carolina.
Federal investigators went inside the wreckage of a U.S. Air jet today looking for additional clues to the cause of last week's aborted takeoff and crash that killed two people in New York. Local authorities also were investigating the accident at the end of the runway at LaGuardia Airport to see if criminal charges are warranted against any of the crew members of the Boeing 747, or rather Boeing 737, bound for Charlotte, North Carolina. Charges that a grand jury might be asked to consider include criminally negligent homicide, vehicular manslaughter, and leaving the scene of an accident. Argentine President Carlos Menem said today that industrialized countries were stifling economic recovery in Argentina. In an address to the United Nations General Assembly, Menem said tariff barriers, subsidies, and other restrictions on fair trade were hurting prospects for growth. The Department of Transportation said today it's seeking details on the ownership and financing structure of the proposed $6.75 billion buyout of UAL Corporation, the parent of United Airlines. In a letter filed with the SEC, Assistant Transportation Secretary Jeffrey Shane said the agency wants to know what agreements have been reached with British Airways. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Duke Ellington, one of America's greatest composers, would have been 90 years old this year. We recently caught up with his son, Mercer, who has been conducting the Ellington Orchestra since Duke's death in 1974. Much of Mercer's life has been spent working with the orchestra. As a young man, he was the gopher. In 1950, he briefly played with the orchestra, and in 1964, he became the road manager. Mercer also wrote several compositions that became part of the orchestra's repertoire, including things like What They Used to Be, Blue Surge, and Jumpin' Pumpkins. Last year, Mercer won a Grammy Award for Best Big Band Jazz Instrumental Album. The Duke Ellington Orchestra, under Mercer's direction, has a recent album called Music Is My Mistress. That title is both the title of Duke Ellington's memoir and the title of an extended composition by Mercer. This is an excerpt of the third movement of Mercer Ellington's Music Is My Mistress. An excerpt of Mercer Ellington's composition, Music Is My Mistress, from his new album of the same name. Mercer Ellington, welcome to Fresh Air.
It's a pleasure being here, Terry.
I was wondering if, in any way, your father's death liberated you as a composer.
Well, in a sense, it allowed us. In fact, you would think that it would have. But that's not true, really. I'm under the same restriction as far as competition is concerned. Competition with myself, early Mercer Ellington, and competition, with Duke Ellington, with the same problem he had. The things that he's written are so perennial that all our audiences request many of the tunes from the past, and they have such a great warmth and a great charm that you have to do them, and, you know. Can you imagine us doing a concert, say, without playing Satin Doll or Mood Indigo or Sophisticated Ladies?
When your father was alive and you wrote a composition, something like, say, Things Ain't What They Used to Be, would he listen to it and then critique it for you?
No. In fact, it was funny you should pick that particular tune, because he called me up. He knew I was out in the street playing around, and he laid for me. He had the clerk in the hotel to give him a ring when I came in, which is about 4:30. And I had been complaining because I wasn't getting the opportunity to write anything and do anything about it. So he waited, and at 4:30 he called me and says, we have a session at 9 o'clock. I want you to do a side for me. I just reached for everything and anything I could find and threw it out there at him. And I've been trying to write like that ever since.
What was his reaction to it when he heard it?
His reaction was always, his compliment was always silence. His negative reaction was a suggestion. Well, you might have done this, or do you think this is possible, or whatever. And much as it was the case with him as an individual, to bring him to a point of decision or to get him to make an absolute statement call for a certain kind of treatment that you had to give him. I'd be in the dither as to how to get from one town to the other, whether to charter the bus, whether we should fly or take the train. If I asked him what should I take, I'd never get an answer. So my way of invoking a decision from him would be, well, Pop, tomorrow we're going to get up at 9 o'clock and take the train out to Philadelphia. And he'd say, well, what's wrong with the airplane? Then I knew we could fly.
Was it understood when your father was getting older that you would take over the band after he died?
Absolutely not. I mean, it never occurred to him. It never occurred to me. Only thing, if it had occurred to me, I would have studied piano much more seriously than I did. But all I cared about was getting into the orchestra. And I knew if I played piano, that wouldn't happen.
Mercer Ellington is my guest, and he's conducted the Duke Ellington Orchestra since Mercer's father's death in 1974. You played in the Ellington Band, didn't
yes.
you? How long did you play?
I was with them for 1 year in 1950 and left to form a record company. And then again, I joined them in 1967 to stay.
Did you have to audition to get in?
No. I guess the word is con my way into the orchestra. When I got in there as a trombone player, they were very short of musicians because the business was so good, everybody who was a soloist could have his own band. But later, he needed a road manager, and all his friends had turned him down because they said they wanted to remain his friend. And the last man he could think of was me, so he called me up and said, I want you to be the road manager. I knew what trouble he'd had in trying to find someone. I said, yeah, I'll do it, on the proviso that I play trumpet as I do the road manager. So he put me in as a fifth wheel. Actually, I was a fifth wheel. There were five trumpets there at the time.
And that's how you became the road manager, too.
Right.
You ended up being the manager of a band where you knew all the musicians since your childhood. And
which is the worst handicap you can have.
Yeah, because they probably thought of you as the kid, even though you weren't the kid anymore.
And it wasn't that so much. It was just one of those things. They thought of me as the gopher.
Oh.
That was my first job.
So you'd have to run out and get stuff. For,
yeah, and I still have it. I have every job left that I started out with. I still go get the sandwiches. I help with the baggage. I help set up the bandstand. And I had to do the copying and also make arrangements.
So how did you gain respect and a sense of authority when you became the road manager?
Never did get any respect, I guess. You talk about Rodney Dangerfield. It was one of those things where, you know, you just hung in there long enough to be accepted. And I think this is the main thing. We had people who joined the band and quit because they'd come in for weeks and nobody even say good morning to them. There were no two men that hung out with each other in that orchestra except Bonnie Bigard and Ben Webster.
You know, it's so hard to imagine that because hearing the orchestra, it's such a really gorgeous unit. And to think of everybody squabbling all the time when they weren't playing is, you know.
Well, I used to call them the Yankees. You know, they were all great musicians and they could play wonderfully together. And they argued like mad, but whenever the weight dropped, I mean, they could come in and they would do the job.
Did you have to worry about disciplining the band members for lateness or for drunkenness or things like that?
you don't discipline a musician for being drunk. I mean, that's part of his creativity. And if you take his inspiration away, it's part of what it takes to be in this business. I was advised by my father to drink because you won't have the inhibition to relax and to even have flowing ideas. I'm not recommending drunkenness. I'm talking about drinking. And so if you're going to drink, one day you're going to have a little bit too much to drink and you will get drunk. But as far as alcohol is concerned, it has constructive purposes. I mean, even now, people advise wine instead of tranquilizers. So I will not admonish, or nor did I try to discipline anybody because of alcohol. I had things I had to try to get, instill. That was making time for bus calls and trying to keep the guys from, going too deep into their money, because I knew most of them had responsibilities. Not all of them, just a few here and there. But that's the kind of discipline you had to worry about.
So how long did you stay the manager of the band?
Until Pop passed away. That was the job, 12 years at it.
Are you still officially the manager as well as the conductor?
Yeah, I told you I got all my jobs.
You're still doing them all, right. Okay. As several people have pointed out, I think music wasn't your father's only mistress.
Well, I mean, since you brought it up, I want you to know that when I wrote the theme title for the album, my way of composing it is that each of the themes represents one of the five most important women in his life.
Mm-hmm.
And the one, it's odd and strange that the one that you picked to play represented one of the most congenial and most beautiful and wonderful ladies of all. Her name was Evie. And it was that she was a very serious lady, and she's a lady he spent really the majority of his life with. He had paramours, but for the most part, she represented his real love. And he, from time to time, would take an excursion, but he always returned home. And as a result, we have a thing of like, I guess if he imagined himself to be anyone, it had to do with sort of his religious belief. And he kind of came up with a feeling that he was somewhat related to King Solomon.
What do you mean?
Well, King Solomon had I would say, a bevy of women who represented him and his concubines and so forth.
How did you feel about your father having paramours? Were you comfortable with that as his son? And did you ever get close to any of the women who your father was in love with?
Well, I think so, particularly with Evie. Mm-hmm. That's the one we were talking about originally.
Mm-hmm.
As far as what he was concerned, the way I felt about it was, this man had done such a marvelous job with himself and for everyone. I can tell you this, that during the course of his lifetime, he took care of an entire family. By that I mean, people who were cousins, uncles, aunts, and so forth, their businesses had failed. And I felt that with him having done so much for other people to make them happy, he was entitled to the happiness which was important to him.
Well, I want to talk with you a little more about your life and about the Duke Ellington Orchestra, but first we're going to take a short break. Mercer Ellington is my guest, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Mercer Ellington is my guest, and he's led the Duke Ellington Orchestra since his father's death in 1974. Mercer and the Duke Ellington Orchestra have just released a new recording called Music Is My Mistress, and I want to play an excerpt of one of Mercer's compositions featured on this new album, and this is called Danish Eyes. Thank you. An excerpt of a composition by Mercer Ellington called Danish Eyes, featured on the new album Music Is My Mistress, with Mercer Ellington conducting the Duke Ellington Orchestra. You are, with the Duke Ellington Orchestra, playing some of Ellington's neglected works, some of the extended works, as well as some of his most popular compositions. When you take out a work that hasn't been played in a long time and you're looking at the score, is it difficult to read? And I ask you that because in a memoir that you wrote about your father, Duke Ellington, you say that he frequently wrote really cryptically because he was afraid that people would steal his composition, which was, I guess, pretty common then, that people would steal other people's ideas. So he'd write it so it couldn't be stolen that easily. Are you stuck with having to decipher that now?
No, not really, because I did so much copying that I recognized his symbols and all the little things he did to disguise the music. For instance, one of them would be to write a part and put the wrong clef sign on it. So if somebody had started naming the notes, they'd have it completely messed up. The other thing was to use, this cryptic titling on numbers so that if you heard a number and you wanted to get it out of the book, like, for instance, you know, he'd make an arrangement that was, say, a new concept of In My Solitude, you'd never find it. If you wanted to say, he did a tune called Squeeze Me. Well, on one occasion, it would be titled Slew Slew. And then another time, he called it Subtle Slough. So if you looked in the in the music to try to, say, take the parts out and copy them over or get some kind of idea of what was happening, you couldn't recognize the tune by the writing that was on it. Well, because the saxophones had one name on it and the trombones had another, and you could never really piece them together.
So how common was stealing through sheet music?
Well, in the days, I mean, it was very blatant at one point. And even in the old Cotton Club days, the guys from downtown would come in with their pencils in their hands and just blatantly sit there with the music and sit in the front row copying down what they heard.
It's amazing. In Music Is My Mistress, your father's collection of memoirs and reminiscences about musicians, he wrote a couple of pages about you, and he started it by saying, "My son Mercer Ellington is dedicated to maintaining the luster of his father's image." Did you ever feel that he perhaps took that for granted?
No, but what he's doing, in essence, he was saying something in print that he could never say to me individually. And it was not necessarily meant for the reader as much as it was meant for me, because he had the difficulty of being able to talk intimately to me. I have the same difficulty. If I had to say to my wife or my children or something else that they did something I liked, I'd find it difficult to make the statement. I think this was his way of expressing approval of what of many of the things I had done, or saying thanks for having done it.
Did he spend a lot of time with you? I know when you were growing up, your parents separated when you were pretty young. You divided your time between each of their houses. Did you get to see him much? Were you close?
Oh, yeah. And in those days, I spent 50-50 mm-hmm. as far as my time was concerned. One half of the year with my mother, or, you know, 2 weeks here and 2 weeks there and so forth. And I got the value of two worlds, and each was very important. I got the value of living, as they would say, high on the hog, because I'd be around Pop and the important people that he knew, and a lot of the, you know, great stars in show business, Fats Waller, Art Tatum, and so forth. And with my mother, we lived an average, everyday existence. No one knew who I was. I was just somebody else on the street. And I got to know how that kind of a person lived. And I never got to the place where I felt I rose above that, that I was not, you know, someone who was highly privileged and could afford to ignore the feelings or the way anyone else felt. So I think for that reason, the way I raised was, in a sense, a rich possession to have.
In a memoir that you wrote about your father, you said that he really wasn't prepared to have children when you were born, and if he was going to have a child, he probably would have preferred a girl, so that when you were raised to please your father, you had to wear these long braids.
We used to call them plaits.
What I couldn't figure out was whether that was something you remembered or something you were told later by your family.
Well, my mother's the one that told me.
How did you feel about it when you found out?
It didn't make any difference to me.
Oh, okay.
I was glad that I was a boy. I was glad he didn't get his wish.
Do you have any of your father's show business superstitions? He had a lot of superstitions,
didn't
he?
Oh, he's gotten us all, you know, a place where we've been brainwashed. And when it gets down to it, there were only two colors which he really, you know, allowed, and that was blue and white. And then once in a while, he allowed a little red to come in. I guess maybe that had to do with his patriotism. But that would, you dare not whistle in the dressing room, nor bring in a newspaper, nor peanuts. And he hated green. Green was always bad luck to him.
Where do these things come from? Do you have any idea?
But it came related to experiences. He hated green, and he hated brown because he was wearing a brown suit the day his mother died.
Oh.
And so he had a reason behind it, an experience to relate to.
So would you wear brown now?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, okay.
I wear green. He, however, did not object to green on the back of dollar bills.
Since so many people know you as the son of Duke Ellington, are people surprised when they find out that you're getting older yourself? You were born in 1919. Do you know what I mean? I think in a lot of people's eyes, you're going to be just perpetually very young.
Ellington has caused a tremendous oversight on my age for quite a while. In the old days, he used to say he didn't want anyone to know he had a son with gray hair because it might keep the chicks away. And then he's still at it even as of now, because I told people, and we had quite a do, you know, in celebrating his 90th birthday. And so they all got to where, they, you know, we got around and took care of each other and everything like that. And all of a sudden they said something about, well, you shouldn't be tired. I explained to them, I said, you know, you've all been so busy celebrating Duke Ellington's 90th birthday that you've forgotten and I'm on my 70th. And I'd like to get some sleep for a change.
Mercer Ellington, I thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you very much for joining us on Fresh
Air. It's been very pleasant, Terry.
Mercer Ellington has conducted the Duke Ellington Orchestra since his father's death in 1974. The most recent album of the orchestra, Music Is My Mistress, features several new compositions by Mercer Ellington. It's on the Music Masters label. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, writer Barbara Grizzuti Harrison. Her latest book, Italian Days, is part travel guide, part personal memoir. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We're listening to music from Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which is now out on home video. Bob Hoskins starred in Roger Rabbit, The Long Good Friday, and Mona Lisa. Coming up, he tells us about the accident that started his acting career. And David Bianculli looks back on a decade and a half of Saturday Night Live. NBC celebrated the show's 15th anniversary this past weekend. David reviews the special and Saturday Night's changing role in pop culture. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush told the UN General Assembly today that the U.S. is prepared to slash chemical weapons stockpiles. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Under the president's plan, the U.S. would destroy 80% of existing chemical weapons stockpiles if the Soviet Union follows suit. Up to 98% of the weapons would be destroyed within 8 years if an international treaty ban is agreed to by all other countries possessing the chemical weapons, including the Soviet Union. Finally, the U.S. would destroy the remaining 2% when all countries sign the ban. However, the plan does not immediately affect the production of new binary chemical weapons, weapons that become lethal only after two chemical agents are mixed and then launched. The president said he believes the Soviets will join in the ban against chemical weapons. I'm Richard Gonzalez in New York.
Dr. Elizabeth Morgan is to be released from jail in Washington, D.C. within the hour. At the order of an appeals court, a D.C. Superior Court judge has signed an order requiring that she be released at 8:06 Eastern Time. Morgan has been in jail 25 months for contempt of court in a child custody dispute. President Bush signed a bill over the weekend designed to free her by placing a one-year limit on civil contempt imprisonments in child custody cases in the District of Columbia. 20,000 school teachers in Utah stayed away from classrooms today to protest a lack of state funding for education. The one-day strike gave more than 400,000 school children an unexpected holiday. From Salt Lake City, NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
This was the first statewide teacher strike in Utah in 25 years, and it was triggered last week by the state legislature. Lawmakers meeting in special session voted to use part of a state budget surplus for a tax cut. Educators wanted the money for higher teacher salaries and textbooks and classroom supplies. Utah teachers are among the lowest paid in the nation. The state spends less per student than almost every other state, and there's a shortage of classroom basics, including books and supplies. Legislative leaders say they'll consider education's needs when the legislature convenes again in January. They still have $55 million surplus dollars to spend. Teachers are planning to return to their classrooms tomorrow, but they say they'll strike again in January if the legislature doesn't devote more money to education. I'm Howard Berkus in Salt Lake City.
General Motors plans to lay off more than 18,000 workers because of a backlog of unsold cars and light trucks. The layoffs at 7 assembly plants will last for 1 to 3 weeks. Last week, GM offered new buyer incentives on a wide range of 1990 models. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 22 points to close at 2,659.19 on volume of some 122 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Many of us were introduced to the British character actor Bob Hoskins through his crime roles, a mob chief in The Long Good Friday, a low-level member of the underworld in Mona Lisa, and a gangster club owner in The Cotton Club. But it was his leading role in the comedy Who Framed Roger Rabbit that made him a star in America. Roger Rabbit is now out on home video. Hoskins played opposite an animated rabbit. The film was hailed as the most convincing attempt to have cartoon characters and actors share the screen. The animated characters were added after the actors did their scenes. That meant Hoskins had to do his part talking to characters that didn't yet exist.
Basically, I had to hallucinate, my daughter, Rosa, who's three, she taught me how to do it. She's got these, she was three at the time, and she's got these invisible friends. And I realized that when I saw Mary Poppins and most of those other shows, it didn't work. You were always aware that this was a gimmick. These were cartoons, and it remained paint. So, and also, your eye lines, if you're that close, it notices that you're not actually looking at someone. You're actually looking through them because your eyes are wide, your pupils are wider apart.
Mm-hmm.
So, like when we're kids, our imagination and reality are blended. They're almost the same thing. It's so close to the front of our head, we can bring it out and look at it. And as we get older, the imagination goes further and further to the back of our head. But I used to sit for hours with Rosa, and she'd sort of play with these imaginary friends, and eventually I saw them. But the problem is that if you do that for 16 hours a day for 5 months, conjuring up these hallucinations, eventually they get out of control.
You know, many of your roles have been underworld characters. In Roger Rabbit, you're a hard-boiled detective. In The Cotton Club and Mona Lisa and The Long Good Friday, you play people in the underworld. Do you gravitate to those kinds of roles?
No, I think they gravitate towards me.
And why do you think they do?
I don't know. Maybe people take me for an underground sort of... I'm pouring some water out, by the way.
Okay.
No, sir. I don't know. I think if you've got a face like mine, you don't usually wind up with the parts that Errol Flynn played, you know?
In the movie Mona Lisa, you played a pretty small-time criminal who gets out of jail and gets a job as a call girl's driver. Kathy Tyson plays the call girl, and she works in very pricey hotels, and in the beginning of the movie, you come to pick her up wearing inappropriate polyesters. And I want to play a short clip from the movie. Here's a scene. We've just picked her up after one of her calls.
And there?
You leave me here.
Good night, then.
You'll have to get yourself some clothes.
Well, we'll have to get myself some clothes.
If you're to drive me. Here, use this.
I'm not having you paying me.
Why not?
You don't even like me.
I can claim it.
In this movie, you play someone who is kind of slowed to comprehend what's happening. I think one of the most frequently... Your character's named George, and one of the most frequently said lines in the movie is, "You don't understand, George." Can I ask you, I don't know if you were conscious of how you did it, but can I ask you how you tried to capture the facial expressions of someone who didn't quite get what was happening around them?
Well, one thing you don't do is concentrate on facial expressions.
Uh-huh.
If you do, you're just making faces. What you've got to do is think the character. You've got to be the character and let the face take care of itself.
I'm going to ask you about one more scene in Mona Lisa. There's a scene where you're driving down a bridge in which a lot of prostitutes work, and the windows are rolled down and the car is stopped, and one of the guys walks over to the car, sticks his head in the window, and starts insulting you. You stare at him and then explode. You just take his head in your hand and start bashing it against the door of the car. Then you throw him out and drive away.
Mm.
What did you think about when you were shooting that scene?
Mainly, I thought about not hurting not hurting Perry. The guy's name was Perry Fennick, and I sort of... like when you're doing that kind of thing, it may look very violent and all the rest of it, but what you're thinking about is, please don't let me make a mistake.
Those sudden outbursts of violence on the part of a character like the one you played give real interesting clues to what kind of character the person is and what kind of tensions they have inside them. Now, I read somewhere that you initially wanted to tone down the violence in the movie, and I wonder why.
Well, it wasn't a question of just toning down the violence. The violence was... it was thoughtless. There was nothing behind it. It was just someone, a violent person. It was... a lot of films that you see are just about someone being violent, a violent person. Well, there are very few people that are just violent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's reasons for them being violent. And the reason I accepted the film, the reason the film appealed to me was that it's a love story, a very strong love story. Although a lot of horrifying things happen, they happen because someone loves somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, was important. There's so many films now about revenge and hatred and sort of viciousness and sadism. But this everything that happened in that film was purely because someone loved somebody.
It's really a very poignant performance that you give in it.
Thank you.
I want to talk to you briefly about another movie that you made, The Long Good Friday.
Mm.
I want to play a scene here. And your character is trying to put together a deal with organized crime concerns from America. While an American is visiting your character in London, some of his English business associates are murdered. And your character gets the idea that they're being murdered because somebody's trying to mess up the deal that you're putting together with the Americans. And here's a scene where you discover a bomb was left in your casino.
I wonder how I got disconnected. Well, the wire must have come loose when Lil opened it.
Stroke of luck, though, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Last night, were there any peculiarities?
Usual crowd. Regular punters, nothing really.
Well, no strangers.
A few Arabs. It's a good night. Nothing unusual.
Nothing unusual, he says. Eric's been blown to smithereens, Colin's been carved up, and I've got a bomb in me casino, and you say nothing unusual?
Did you try to hang out with any gangsters, mobsters, before doing this role?
Yeah.
You did?
Yeah, well, I it must have been crazy, really. I went down to these clubs and met a load of gangsters and said, teach me to be a gangster.
What kind of clubs?
Well, sort of gangsters' clubs. Where all the gangsters hang out.
Well, what do you do? Go and say, hi, I'm an actor. I'll be playing a guy kind of like you. So
no, but I
went in
and said, I'm playing a gangster in a film.
Mm-hmm.
Can you teach me to do it? And they thought it was very amusing.
I guess it's kind of flattering to their ego.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, there were a lot of real villains, actually, in the film. Like, there was one scene in it where apart from the crew and me and Derek Thompson, there wasn't one person in that room that wasn't under suspicion of committing a murder. There was a very heavy, heavy mob. It was quite funny, actually, because at one time I was doing a scene and I was shouting and screaming and doing a thing, and one of these guys came up and said, hey, you don't have to do that. I said, what do you mean? He said, you don't have to shout. They know who you are. And I'm like, right, fine, yeah, okay. So I was very quiet after that.
That's great.
And the scene worked.
Well, did you get any cards or phone calls from any of the people who you apprenticed after they saw the movie?
No. Well, one guy who was quite a famous villain in London escaped from prison. Just after I'd made the film. And I was in a pub and someone came in and said, someone wants to see you. I thought, oh, God, what's this? He said, no, it's okay. And this guy had was on the run and he was hunted by Interpol and all kinds of people. And I walked into the pub and there he was, standing there. He said, listen, Bob, I've seen the tape of the film, and I just want to say we're glad to see one of our own doing well. I thought, I've never hurt anybody in my life. What are you talking about? And certainly never killed anybody.
So you didn't call the police afterwards and tell them that you just met with this guy, did you?
No, certainly not. I just went back to the pub and with trembling hands had a very large scotch.
That's great. Well, I want to talk with you more about your life and your acting, but first we're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Actor Bob Hoskins is my guest. Can we talk a little bit about your background? I'm real curious about what kind of neighborhood you grew up in.
Working class.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of a normal working class area. There was, you know, a mixture of hardworking people, layabouts, villains, gamblers. Like a normal area, you know. It was a mixture of everything.
Which side were you gravitating to when you were a teenager?
Survival, I think. Like, you know, just to earn a living. I was never a great great one for... I was never very clever. Like, by sort of... What I mean is... I don't mean I'm stupid. What I mean is, like, street talk and the street kind of survival, where some people really thrive on the street. You know, some people become very rich on the street. I never did. I was so pretty ordinary, really. It was only when I was pretending to be on the street that I started to, to get rich.
I don't know if this is a true story or not, but the story that goes around, which I suppose is true, is that you got your first role by accident.
Mm, yeah.
Right? Would you tell the story?
Well, yeah. God, it sounds terrible now. I was in a bar in an amateur theatre, and there was a lot of people there sort of reading these, well, at the time were scripts. I didn't know what a script was. And this guy came down and said, right, you're next. And I, oh, am I? And I'd had enough drink to sort of think, oh, OK, I feel a bit adventurous. Went upstairs and they said, have you seen the script? I said, no, what does it look like? And they gave me the script, said, do you want to read it? And I read it, and they said, well, do you want to read it out loud so we can hear it? So I read it out loud, and I got the part. I was playing the lead in this play. And the first night, an agent came to see it and said, you should take this up professionally. I said, well, get us a job, and I will. And she did. And I've been a professional actor ever since.
So who did you learn from? Did you learn from a lot of the actors and directors that you worked with when you started performing on stage?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mainly learned from women.
Why is that?
Well, I realised very early on that, like, drama is about very private moments. Like, most of the time, people walking around hide behind a sort of shield of style or whatever. But drama is about showing those very private moments, those painful moments, those ridiculous moments that make up the human life. And because women have had to keep their mouths shut for sort of thousands of years, they developed this technique of making those private moments felt very clearly. Like, you can walk in a room, and if there's been a row between two women, you know. You know what I mean? Or if a woman sort of wants you to know something without telling you, you know. And that's the job of an actor, to make an audience know.
No, see, what I find interesting, too, about what you're saying is that you have an incredible style on screen. But I understand what you're saying, too, is that what makes a good performance is having that style and let the inside stuff show behind it.
Yeah.
To have those breakthroughs to what's behind the style.
Yeah, yeah. Well, 90% of the job, 90% of being an actor is just telling the story.
Right, right.
But it's that 10% where that inner thing has got to show.
Was your Cockney accent ever a problem in roles you had to play?
Not really, no.
Did you have to learn different accents when you started acting? Did you already know how to do that?
Yeah, well, I suppose if a guy... I've always told jokes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to tell jokes, there's always racial jokes. And I used to tell all kinds of racial jokes, you know. all kinds of different accents.
So you have to do accents to tell the jokes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, gosh. You know, while we're talking about actors and actresses who you learn from, I know you performed, I think, pretty early in your career in a play with John Gielgud.
Yeah.
Did you learn anything from him?
Yes, I did. Well, he was extraordinary, Gielgud. Because I had only been in the business, two, 3 years. And suddenly I was on stage in a 40-minute scene with John Gielgud, and I had all the lines. I couldn't believe it. And he was wonderful. He was really wonderful to work with. And I'll never forget, I had a line in the scene. What was it? I can't remember what the line was now, but it was a funny line. It was a gag line.
Uh-huh.
And, but it wasn't getting as much as I thought it should get, you know?
As much laughter?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I said to him, you know, what am I... I said, I'm not getting enough out of this. He said, well, what you should do, he said, is when you come to the line, step back 2 paces, count 2, and then say it. What? You got to be kidding. No, 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 it'll be fine, 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 I promise you. And So he came to me. I'd forgotten about this. And he was sitting up on this big box all the way through the scene. And I came to the line and he shouted out down to me, "Step back 2 paces and count two." I said, "Oh, you've killed it. Thanks a lot." So I did. I stepped back 2 paces, counted two. And the audience went crazy. I got around. And I looked up at him, and he's not very good at winking. And there he is, trying to wink at me. You know, "I told you so." Well, after that, I did it again the night afterwards. And I got another round. I thought, he must be doing something up there. What's he doing? This can't be me. So the night after, I did it again. And quick, as soon as I said it, I whipped round and looked at him again. And he was still sitting there trying to wink at me. You know, he wasn't doing a thing. And every night after that, I stepped back 2 paces, counted two, and got around. And I could never figure this out. And ever since, every single show I've ever done, there's always a point where I'll step back 2 paces, count two, and I've never got a thing, not a titter. It's never worked since.
So that's not something that has changed your career forever from
no,
this
no,
little
no,
lesson.
No, it's driving me nuts.
Do you think he was really like making faces at the audience or doing something behind your back?
Well, I thought he was, and I thought I'd catch him out, but he wasn't, no.
That's funny. Thanks so much for talking with us. I've really enjoyed hearing from you immensely. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Bob Hoskins, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, is now out on home video. Hoskins stars as a bigoted police officer in the comedy Heart Condition, scheduled to open in February. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel in Washington with a look ahead at what's on All Things Considered today. We'll be hearing about President Bush's speech to the UN General Assembly. He spoke about, among other things, chemical weapons. We'll hear about his proposal for reductions. Also, about the damage inflicted by Hurricane Hugo on Charleston, South Carolina, where we hear that some of the older buildings withstood the storm better than some of the newer ones did. And also from St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands, where we hear from the governor about what he's doing about the outbreak of looting last week and what kind of investigation he's launching into the conduct of uniformed services there. And also Linda Wertheimer on the beginning of fall in the nation's capital. It's all coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Saturday Night Live is entering its 15th season. On Sunday, they celebrated with a primetime special full of highlights and with cast members and guest hosts who've kept the show going year after year. Television critic David Bianculli has a review of the special and of the Saturday Night Live legacy.
Someone said to me today, coming into the studio, "Hey, Old Timers Day, huh?" And I got upset. And it sort of is, in a way. It's the men have been in makeup longer than the women.
It just so happens that the premiere of Saturday Night Live was my first official review as a television critic. That was in 1975, when Gerald Ford was president and TV's idea of a show with youth appeal was Tony Orlando and Dawn. Then along came Saturday Night. It was the first show to give voice to a new generation of comics and to provide topical and outrageous humor for a new generation of viewers. It was on late at night, which made it almost a cult show. And for a while, it was the only place on TV to see the kinds of music and comedy it offered. If you missed the anniversary show, here's Dan Aykroyd and Bill Murray as Walter Cronkite and Jimmy Carter in a skit where Carter takes phone calls on a live TV special.
Hello? Hello?
Yeah. Hello? Hello, Peter?
Is this the president?
Yes, it is.
Do you have a question for the president?
I took some acid. I'm afraid to leave my apartment and I can't wear any clothes. And the ceiling is dripping, and,
Well, thank you very much for calling, sir. Please,
Just a minute, Walter. This guy's in trouble. I think I better try to talk him down. Peter?
Yeah?
Peter, what did the acid look like?
They were these little orange pills.
Were they barrel-shaped?
Yes.
Okay, right. You did some orange sunshine, Peter.
Well, the times have changed, all right. Drugs are no laughing matter anymore, especially not after John Belushi died from them. Saturday Night Live isn't the last frontier for young comics, either. It's more like a springboard to movie stardom. And at 15 years old, Saturday Night Live is a comedy institution, younger than Bob Hope and Johnny Carson, but much older than David Letterman. and sometimes it's hard to be radical when you've got tenure. But the current cast, now starting its fourth season, is quite good and still scores big points when it makes fun of politics. Here's Jan Hooks moderating a mock presidential debate in which Dana Carvey is George Bush and John Lovitz is Michael Dukakis.
You still have 50 seconds left, Mr. Vice President.
Well, let me just sum up. On track, stay the course, 1,000 points of light, stay the course.
Mm-hmm. Governor Dukakis, rebuttal.
I can't believe I'm losing to this guy.
It's worth noting that, by my count, more than a dozen former members of the Saturday Night Live cast, people like Gilbert Gottfried, Charles Rocket, and Denny Dillon, weren't visible in any of the anniversary highlights. As for the special itself, I wish it had included more interaction between new and old cast members. The opening was great, but the opening was it. Saturday Night Live has had its weak moments and its weak seasons, but it manages to keep moving and surviving, like a shark, a land shark. This Saturday, Bruce Willis guest hosts the season opener, with Neil Young as the latest in a long line of memorable musical guests.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post.
Big bottom! Big bottom! Talk about bum cakes! My girl's got them!
I'm alone with you. Who can it be knocking at my door?
Her parents said, girl, don't leave home.
Should I go?
Because you're mine, I walk the line.
Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblitis, Joyce Lieberman, Dan Lachlan, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with columnist Ellen Goodman. Also, Barbara Grizzuti Harrison travels through Italy and at the center of Catholicism finds herself shopping for the right church to attend. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.